Word of mouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is a special fundraising edition of Word of Mouth from NHPR. For some people, vacation means relaxing on a white sand beach. For others, it's an opportunity to soak in the culture of a European city. Well, for those seeking a different kind of travel experience, there's a new game in town, drug tourism. Guided trips to places like Amsterdam, Indonesia, or Peru allow vacationers to indulge in substances illegal here in the U.S. Writer Christine Sismondo traveled to Peru to experience this growing industry for herself, and she wrote about it for The Smart Set. And a quick note to parents and sensitive listeners. We in no way endorse using drugs, but are going to be hearing a firsthand account of an experience in a place where they are legal and part of a long cultural tradition. So with that out of the way, hello, Christine.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Really excited to talk to you about this. We know Amsterdam for its hash bars, Southeast Asia for various different kinds of drugs and vices, among other things. So what is it that's luring people to Peru?
Peru actually has more than just the ayahuasca, which I wrote about. Peru has a number of drugs that are illegal in other places that have been kept legal there for cultural reasons. So the first one would be coca tea, which is not really white powder cocaine or anything close to that, but it helps people adjust to the altitude. And they're under a fair bit of pressure to make that illegal from the United Nations. And the second one is a form of mescaline called San Pedro, which people in the Andes drink. It's a cactus that sort of melted down and turned into a tea. And the third is, of course, the ayahuasca, which is more common in the rainforest. And the indigenous people there drink that also sort of like a tea and experience a long, protracted high.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the history and the tradition of using ayahuasca.
I think that the thing that's sort of important to note about all of this isn't like a weekend party drug to the people who are using it. It's the guide that we had, we spent about a week with a guide in the rainforest, and his name was Oscar, and he was absolutely fantastic. He had grown up there. His uncle was a shaman. His father was a shaman. And he had, I think, taken ayahuasca four times in his life. They tend to do it during periods when you're either sort of mentally stressed or physically ill. And it's almost a diagnostic tool.
What do you mean a diagnostic tool? It just sort of points out what you need help with or what's wrong?
Exactly. The shaman uses it to try to identify what's wrong with the person that he's helping to heal.
We're talking with Christine Sismondo about the growing trend of ayahuasca use in Peru, where it is legal and it's being sold as part of vacation packages for ecotourism companies there. And as far as drugs go, ayahuasca has not been a household name. You know, certainly it's not a street drug. But you're observing that things are changing. And how so, and why do you think that is?
It sort of hit the cultural consciousness. It's interesting because it was about 50 years ago that it first sort of became noticed by people like William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg. And then more recently, it's having a bit of a, I don't know, I guess a renaissance. And I think it has mostly to do with the fact that it's become accessible, in that none of us are really up to going to the same extremes and lengths that somebody like William Burroughs would have gone to. He incidentally went there because he thought it might be a cure for his heroin addiction. But none of us are probably willing to go quite as far as he was, because he was going through sort of uncharted territories and trying to find shamans who would help him try this drug that really Westerners weren't commonly doing. So now, though, there are more well-traversed routes for people to go. The thing that I did was actually a package deal, and that's what made me interested in it. It came in my email inbox one day, and it was this offer to go and enjoy the nature reserve in the Tambopata at Rainforest Adventures. And you could sort of adjust the package to do whatever you wanted, wildlife spotting, more of a sort of a spa treatment, and one of the spa treatment packages was ayahuasca, and I actually found it kind of hilarious.
That is so funny. Sort of all-inclusive, you wear this bracelet and get all your drinks and meals free and a dose of ayahuasca.
I know. That's exactly it. I thought it was sort of funny that they were offering it in this way because I had read just a tiny bit about ayahuasca before, and what I'd read was almost horrific, you know, this sort of idea of purging, and I had read that people have fairly extreme bodily reactions to it. So that paradox sort of got me interested.
Well, what was it like for you, Christine?
You know, again, I wouldn't want to endorse it for a lot of people either, necessarily. It was a little scary at first, and we felt we were in extremely good hands where we were. But it was kind of, nonetheless, still a little bit terrifying, especially since a lot of people feel like they're dying when it first goes in.
And you did too, didn't you?
I did. I totally did.
You had the typical purge reaction. There's a lot of vomiting.
Yeah, not so much. Not as much as you hear. But I was checking my pulse before. And then when I did throw up, I was really relieved to do so because I felt like I was getting some of the poison out of my body.
But do you think you ever came to whatever state or, you know, place of diagnostic possibility that you were told could come out of this experience?
Well, the reports are really wide-ranging about what people experience. And some people say that they get nothing less than a full-on sort of religious experience with insights into the origin of the universe. I didn't have that or anything close to that. Other people say that they get insights into their primary relationships. I wouldn't say I necessarily had exactly that either. I think that a lot of what I felt was sort of actually things that you could figure out pretty easily on your own, but I did think I felt them kind of more profoundly, like, you know, you should try to be a better person. You should try to be more generous with people, those sorts of things. So they were actually kind of banalities, I would say, but I felt them very strongly.
Now, you talked about primary relationships. Your husband was also with you on this trip, I guess I can use that word,
yeah,
of various different sorts. What was the experience like for him?
Well, it was pretty hilarious. He had been sick the year before, and I had forgotten to mention that to the shaman. So that kind of added to my concern that this was a really, really stupid thing to have done when I was first doing it. But he was just sort of lying there, and I thought, oh, no, I've killed him. I've taken him into the jungle and killed him. And then the shaman asked if we wanted a second dose, and I said, no, 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 I'm great. And he said, yeah, I'll take a second dose. Anyhow, he had a good experience, but I would say he felt less of the sort of, oh, I should fix my life kind of things that I did. I also felt very strongly that that the stress that we all experience, it could be manageable, that I could feel in some way. That was probably the biggest thing that I took out of it, which was that bodily stress, I could probably work harder to make that a less terrible experience. And I felt like it was possible. And I've never really noticed that before.
Hmm. Now, this was put together by Rainforest Expeditions, this package.
That's right.
You're writing in that Peru is not simply taking money from tourists and investing it in conservation. So what are they trying to do? What about this was a rainforest or eco tour kind of enforcing experience for you?
Well, Rainforest Expeditions is basically almost 100% indigenous owned. There's a lease partnership for a short period of time with a company from Lima that helped them sort of get off the ground and figure out how to offer these sort of services. And ayahuasca is by no means the most popular service that they're offering. But the lease ends, and at some point it will go entirely back to the indigenous community. And what I think is really interesting about what they're doing there with the ayahuasca, with the nature tourism, with the animal spotting, all of it, is that they're making that land more valuable to preserve than to exploit. And as you probably know, the price of gold has made that area very volatile. There's concerns about mercury poisoning from the way that the gold is being extracted. And so the antidote to that is ecotourism, for all that it has its faults, and serious faults they are. At least that's something that provides an incentive to preserve the rainforest as opposed to just exploit it.
Christine Sismondo, an author who writes mostly about America's long relationship with alcohol. Her article about drug tourism in Peru appeared in the Smart Set. Christine, I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
So from the potential ecological benefits of drug tourism in Peru to the technological innovations that could change how you live, word of mouth is all about unearthing unexpected stories and ideas that stick in your mind and challenge you to think about the world in a new light. Your support helps us bring you the stories that surprise and inform and delight. We're in the middle of our fall fun drive, so now is a great time to show your support for word of mouth and NHPR.
Hi, I'm Word of Mouth producer Logan Shannon, reminding you that if you'd like to give right now, you can call 1-888-805-6477, or you can go online to nhpr.org. And thanks.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sylvester Graham would have hated the s'more. The inventor of the graham cracker was no ordinary food entrepreneur. He was the fervent leader of one of America's first big diet trends. Only Graham's strict regimen of bland foods was not about losing weight or lowering cholesterol. The graham cracker was part of a health movement designed to squelch America's sexual urges. Here to tell us more about this forgotten bit of food history is Adi Braun, who wrote about Sylvester Graham for The Atlantic. Hello, Adi.
Hi, Virginia.
So tell us more about Sylvester Graham and what led him to prominence as a 19th century health guru.
Yeah, so Sylvester Graham was an evangelical reverend in America during the first half of the 19th century in the Northeast. He came out of these social and health reform movements that were gaining popularity at the time. So the temperance movement, the early feminists, the abolitionists, this was pre-Civil War America, the people promoting kind of alternative health and lifestyles, like anti-tobaccoist, anti-caffeine. He came out of this, and he really made a name for himself initially by giving these very fiery speeches to young men, warning them against the dangers of masturbation. So Graham believed that the more exciting and therefore the more immoral the sexual act, the worse it was for your health. So he had this kind of sliding scale of sexual depravity. On the one end, you had marital sex, which was the most innocuous, and that was okay, but only once a month, because beyond that was excessive and pathological. And on the other hand, you had self-stimulation, which was, in Graham's mind, the most exciting and therefore the most harmful. And in fact, he blamed the cholera epidemic of 1832 in part to these excessive sexual behaviors. You know, he saw gluttony as part of this commercialization, you know, materialism. And so out of these ideas about reigning in excess and repressing people's sexual urges, he formulated a comprehensive lifestyle plan, which he called the Graham System of Living. At the heart of this system was the Graham diet. It prohibited the drinking of alcohol, you know, no tobacco, no caffeine, no spices. That was too exciting for him, and no meat. Graham was one of the fathers of the early American vegetarian movement, and the diet really consisted of fruits, vegetables, a little bit of dairy, and whole wheat. And whole wheat became increasingly important to Graham.
Among those staples that he took issue with was white bread. What was his opposition?
Yeah, so white bread was really a problem for Graham. What was happening at the time was the era of early industrialization, and with it came the beginnings of the commercial food industry. And all of these additives were being put into the white bread, copper, alum, clay, chalk, all these things to make it whiter and also to extend its shelf life. You know, Graham may have been exaggerating the health crisis a bit, so much so, in fact, that he wrote an entire a book about how to make homemade bread out of whole wheat flour. And whole wheat flour, Graham was convinced, would restore Americans to health. Whole wheat flour, you know, gave the teeth a workout. It led to a healthy colon, you know, a healthy, strong colon. So he had all these ideas about the health benefits of whole wheat. And so he wrote his book laying out in very careful detail not only how to make homemade bread, but how to make whole wheat flour. And he called the whole wheat flour Graham flour.
Uh-huh.
And his Graham bread, and that eventually became what we know today as Graham crackers. But, you know, of course, his bread had no sugar or spices in it. And, of course, Graham crackers today include those ingredients, and it's also a commercial product. So
Graham's countering of our animalistic desires that were getting the better of us gave rise to the Graham cracker, now a Nabisco-branded snack. You write that his lifestyle advice included some pretty sensible advice. What else besides Graham crackers did Sylvester Graham prescribe?
His lifestyle plan was pretty ascetic. You know, he advocated for pretty radical health and hygiene habits, you know, getting regular exercise and bathing regularly, getting fresh air and drinking fresh water, also wearing loose clothing. You know, he believed that tight-fitting clothing was bad for the body, going to bed at this very prescribed time, getting up early. I mean, it was all about the rituals of the day and making sure that people weren't straying too far from it. It was a very restrictive way of life. His popularity lasted a few years, really, in the sort of early to mid-1830s, before I think he became even too extreme for his Grahamites, as they call themselves, his followers.
You write also about one very notable Grahamite, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, a name familiar to all of us. What did he do with Graham's prescriptions?
Yeah, so Graham died in 1851, I believe. So fast forward about 40 years, and in Battle Creek, Michigan, it was a health spa, and it was run by Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, who was a Graham disciple. And he was always concocting these new food products, and he was kind of tooling around the kitchen one day and created this cereal. He served it to his patients, went over quite well. And he started marketing it, and eventually that became known as cornflakes.
Who would you likely compare Sylvester Graham to today? Would he be more food guru and author Michael Pollan, or the evangelical leader Pat Robertson?
Probably a combination of both. I mean, I would say that the thing that really separates Graham from somebody like Michael Pollan is he's a bit of an extremist. You know, I mean, he was all about this very regimented diet, and it certainly was linked to religion, but I would say less so than in evangelical ministers that we have today. You know, his diet was more along the lines of these kind of fad diets, you know, the paleo diet, South mm-hmm. Beach diet, a baby food diet. Even Atkins, I would say, is more kind of similar to what he was promoting.
Adi Braun, thank you for opening up this really odd chapter of history for us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Adi Braun, she's written for NPR, for Lapham's Quarterly, and The Atlantic, where you can find her recent article on the 19th century food guru Sylvester Graham. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. Whether talking about the chaste origins of the Graham cracker or the art of furniture making, here at Word of Mouth, we strive to bring you stories and conversations that you can share with your friends and your family. And you are an integral part of that conversation, because all the stories you hear on NHBR and Word of Mouth are brought to you by you. It's listener support that allows us to present not only quality news and analysis, but programs that speak to your sense of curiosity and wonder of the world. If you rely on NHBR to shed a little light on some new corners of happenings in the world, please let us rely on you with your listener support. We're in the midst of our fall fund drive, so now is the time to show that support. And thank you.
I'm Word of Mouth producer Logan Shannon, reminding you that if you'd like to give right now, you can call 1-888-805-6477. And you can, of course, go online to nhpr.org. Thanks.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With the rise of the maker movement in recent years, more and more people are getting their hands dirty with projects of all kinds, You can see proof of that on websites like Etsy, where you can find and buy a staggering variety of handmade artisanal products. While the appeal of the maker movement is to learn a skill and make some really cool stuff, our guest Peter Korn says the real benefit is not what you make, but the time spent making it. Peter Korn's latest book is called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. In addition to being an author, he's a master furniture maker and founder and executive director of the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship. That's a nonprofit woodworking and design school in Rockport, Maine. Peter, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Virginia, pleasure to be here.
So you admit that woodworking is a pretty marginal field in many ways, but the book is part of the story of your evolution into that field. Let's begin with how you kind of fell into it.
Okay. Well, I had never worked with my hands all the way through college, and I also always felt in college like I was living life secondhand somehow, although I didn't know how. But I certainly was looking for real life when I finished. And in 1972, I moved to Nantucket Island, which was a really empty, quiet place at the time. And the first job that came along was as a carpenter. So much to my father's horror, I took a job as a carpenter, because he wanted me to be a lawyer or something equivalent. And I found I was horrible at being a carpenter at first, of course, but as soon as I got the hang of it, I found that I loved it, and it was a lot more intellectually engaging as well as physically engaging than anything I'd been led to expect.
So within a year, your fingers start getting muscly. You buy a Ford truck.
All those things. young hippie carpenter with a dog, yeah, and a beard. I became a furniture maker because after 2 years as a carpenter, I made a cradle for some friends. And it was really a trial and error way of making a cradle. I didn't know anything about joinery or fine furniture making. But as soon as I was done it, I quit my carpentry job and dedicated myself to figuring out how to make furniture. Mm-hmm. And really all I was thinking about was the how of it, trying to rediscover how do you sharpen a chisel, how do you use a hand plane, how do you cut a dovetail. And I designed each new piece only so that I could incorporate a new technique in it I wanted to learn.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't thinking about design.
Right.
But after 5 or 10 years of that, I started to get really interested in design and realized that that was even more interesting than making things. Mm. So I went from sort of the how of things to thinking about design, and then after some period of time, I started wondering about the why of it.
You're hitting on something that I really enjoyed about reading this. Is first of all, there is a photograph of that cradle among many other projects that you have undertaken through the years. But you know, creative people can't always articulate the process of making things, and a lot of the book is actually about that. And there's this kind of realization of your aesthetic goals as a furniture maker beginning to align with the person you want to be. And I'm just wondering if that is something that arrived upon you, or is this just a gradual process?
It's a gradual process of growing up and broadening my perspective. Really, I read letters that I wrote when I was in my carpenter in my 20s. You know, I don't like that person very much, actually. That was a really self-absorbed young man. And so it's been a long, slow process.
The ego is a big part of making for a lot of people. And that's something that you write about. The motivation for making is not a quest for fame or money or even self-expression. Then what is it?
I think it's a process of self-discovery. And I honestly think that the single thing that we all do that defines our humanity is we spend our lives making up and maintaining our own story of who we are and how the world works. And I think that creative work in general is a great way to extend and explore that. And for me, especially in the early days, becoming a furniture maker was a way of building a person.
Mm. But I think a lot of people heading into the studio or the kitchen or the garden, they have this idea of the goal. This is what I want to come out with. This is me expressing myself.
If you went into the studio knowing what you were going to end up with, you wouldn't even walk in the door. The fact is, the creative work is always a process of discovery where you don't know what you're going to come out with, and that's what makes a creative work, and that's what makes it engaging. The primary reason why I got involved in furniture making and practice it really was as a process of self-transformation, discovery in the studio. I really do think that's why every creative person I've ever met does the work. The world doesn't really need another mug or symphony or novel, does it? I mean, it's got plenty of them. It's not pounding on our doors asking for them. We do it because it's an internal drive that gets us to do it.
Peter Korn is with us. He's written a new book. It's kind of part memoir, part meditation, and called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. We're living in this moment of reviving craft, you know, the makers movement. Shop Class of Soulcraft was a big bestseller. Slow food. This happened after the Industrial Revolution and other times like the 1970s when you got started. Is this something that we're just going to see cycle around every few decades, or is it here to stay? What do you think?
I think that the urge to build things is biologically intrinsic to human beings. We've been making things to further our survivals through millions of years of evolution. So I'm convinced that we just want and need and get satisfaction out of handling natural materials and making things with them. I have no question about that. And I'm delighted about the maker movement. And these are young people who feel a need to rediscover how to make and rediscover the world for themselves, just like I and my generation did 40 years ago. So I think it is cyclical, but I think there will be people hungrier and hungrier for it. And when they discover it, their passion will light up.
That is very interesting to consider, because I think of the woodworker, you know, the lone craftsperson. It's a very solitary scene for me. But you talk about it as a sort of a way of connecting with society. How do you merge those
two things? First of all, it was very solitary for the people in the studio craft movement, by and large. We our ideal was to have a little shop behind the house and go back and bury ourselves in it. And I like to say that studio craft, if I had to explain what it is, we confused virtuosity with virtue. We tried really hard to get good at it and to make things that could only come from our own hands and our own mind. And when I see the makers movement today, or when I see something I'm excited about, which is sort of what I'll call the studio product design movement that's centered in Brooklyn but is all over the country, where young people, they are designing things without that isolation. They're designing and making things, and then they're making them for production by other people. I find that a different outlook that's really exciting.
Technology is being used a lot in making furniture. I'm thinking of places like IKEA and West Elm, you know, making very inexpensive furniture. And locally, this is one of the more common criticisms against the artisanal movement, that goods are just too expensive for regular people to buy. And I'm wondering about your thoughts on that.
I've been talking about my book to groups around the country. And one thing that comes up often, and this is important to me, is that in mainstream culture that we live in, the only yardsticks we seem to be provided with for measuring the value of what we do are money and fame. How much does it sell for? How famous is the artist? Or how much, you know, attention does the thing we make get? And those are really poor yardsticks for measuring the value of creative work to a person or a life or society. So one of the things I'm hoping about the book is it will contribute to a conversation about what our other yardsticks should be for valuing creative work. And I think one of the mistakes we make as creative people, as artists, as craftspeople, is buying into this money and fame idea, so that we think that we're only valid at it, or only makes a difference for us if we're actually selling things and making our living at it. And from my point of view, it is just as valuable if you're doing it as an avocation, as a hobby. It doesn't have to be a profession, your creative work. The bottom line for me is this: having written the book, I learned a lot. And what I've discovered is my bottom line is that the sort of meaning and fulfillment that we all seem so hungry for doesn't have to be found in craft. It doesn't have to be found in art. But where it lies is in the hard work of having an idea and then translating it into the physical world in a way that matters and makes a difference. It could be an idea for a table. It could be an idea for a painting. But it could be an idea for a new business. It could be an idea in the science laboratory you're exploring. It's exercising our creative muscle that is where we inhabit our humanity to the fullest.
Peter Korn, founder and executive director for Furniture Craftsmanship. That's a nonprofit woodworking and design school in Rockport, Maine. His latest book is called Why We Make Things and Why It Matters.